little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
That's me. Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
Doing all right for this beautiful fall day.
It is beautiful. I love the change of seasons up in our neck of the woods here in Northern California. Let's kick it off as we usually do, Julia, by telling folks how they can get in touch with us to give us feedback about the show and how they can pop up our previously archived podcast version of Thinking Clearly.
Absolutely. Well, behind these microphones, Bob and I are real people, and we like to hear from you, our very real listening audience. We also have a Facebook page, Thinking Clearly Radio. Just put that in your search bar. Thinking Clearly should come right up, and you can find promos as well as show notes posted there. And then I don't know about you, but I am quite the podcaster these days. So you can find Thinking Clearly on your podcast app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just open it up, search Thinking Clearly, and you can find our entire archive. What, 5 years now, Bob?
Over 5 years. Yep.
Incredible. And if you're not the podcast app type, but you want to listen to the archive, you can just visit us on the web, thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com.
And we do have a great guest all connected up with us, so we're going to get right to that. I want to just say, though, that in addition to his other accomplishments, our guest on this edition of Thinking Clearly appeared with Bill Maher on Bill's show. And in the 11 minutes that they had together, our guest successfully got a lot of important information out with a minimum of comedic interruptions by Bill Maher, which is an accomplishment in itself. And at the end of the interview, Bill Maher said, "Thank you. You put a lot in perspective. I appreciate it." So, Julia, with that little teaser in mind, why don't you frame the topic for us?
Well, today's topic is when making a judgment about what to do when there's risk involved, it becomes important to look at the consequences of our actions. This involves accurately assessing both the risks and benefits to ourselves and others of those actions. But what does it mean to assess risks and benefits, and how do we do that? These are the topics for this episode of Thinking Clearly.
And with a background in journalism and television reporting, where he specialized in issues relating to science and the environment, our guest, David Ropeek, developed expertise on risk perception and risk communication and began a career as an international consultant, author, teacher, and speaker. And in addition to teaching risk-related courses at Harvard University, David wrote the book titled, "How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts," and then co-authored a previous book called Risk, A Practical Guide for Deciding What's Really Safe and What's Really Dangerous in a World Around You. And he also created and directed a training program for journalists to improve media coverage of risk. David Ropeek, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, I think Julia has the first question to kick us off, David, but I do want to note that we are pre-recording this interview, so there will be no listener call-ins for this edition of Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, David. Well, I guess we'll kind of just start with a little bit about you and your background. As Bob mentioned in the intro, your early career was in journalism. How did you end up specializing in risk assessment of all things?
So a regular general assignment reporter covers lots of stories that involve risk because we're always covering dramatic things that happen to people, right? They crash, they burn, they die, all those dramatic things that make headlines. And so it occurred to me that a pattern was showing up where I'd ask people how afraid they were of that thing, airbags in cars for kids or the new chemical du jour or being shot in that neighborhood. It didn't matter what the risk was. They were often either more afraid than the experts who I would interview then said they needed to be, or in some cases, less afraid of the risk than the experts said they ought to be. Like, lots of people were afraid of the chemicals in the school building, but smoked, or afraid of driving into Boston because I'll get shot, which was true in a couple neighborhoods, but that's all for a week or two, whether during a gang war, but weren't getting their flu shot. So these patterns made me think, this is happening all the time, and it doesn't matter what the risk is. We're getting it wrong. We're getting risk wrong, over-worrying or under-worrying. So this is back in the 90s, before God made the internet, and I went on to the library. Yeah, we used to have those, and looked up the research on the psychology of risk perception. And there was this fascinating body of research about how we are just not good critical thinkers when it comes to risk perception. So I started doing stories about that. That led to my position at the Harvard School of Health's Center for Risk Analysis, where they did a quantitative, nice, good critical thinking numbers sort of risk assessment scientifically. And I would argue to all the scientists who I was trying to get good public relations for, that's not how people do it. They get it wrong all the time. And they said, okay, let's start to teach it. And that led to here I am today.
Yeah, just like in economics, we're not rational actors.
So, well, in fact, the body of research that I was referring to started with economics.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So why isn't $1 worth $1 to everybody?
Exactly.
You know, and Homo economicus is just, as we now know, an old school rationalist way of falsely describing how people actually make choices about things, especially when our safety is at risk. Risk is, you have to understand, the word risk implies, could I die? Right? The ones we're talking about aren't money. The risk I'm talking about are health. Although the research started with economics, it led by Paul Slovic and Baruch Fischoff and a lot of others into physical risk. And what we're talking about now is surviving. And that's a really important foundation of this whole conversation, because we're not talking about some abstract choice, some fact-based, numeric sort of critical thinking choice. We're talking about I could die. That evokes all kinds of profound instincts, as the research has illuminated.
And you've used the term perception gap for that approach, the idea that there's a difference between the rational analytical assessment of risk and our personal assessments of risk. So let's get into the details of that a little bit more, because risks are things that can do harm to us or other people, right? And when I look into the literature a little bit, I can see that there are different categories of risks. We can have physical risks. We can have risks to us psychologically or socially or economically. And risks require, when we're looking at them, other than an intuitive, quick approach, system one, and we've talked about system one, system two on this show quite a bit. When we really start looking at them, we'll see that risks have both a magnitude and a probability. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I do get back to that idea of the perception gap, because it is another foundation for our conversation. It's just a phrase that I invented to try and popularize or spread thinking about the gap between our fears and the facts. The subtitle of my second book, you know, Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Well, we all know that we over-worry about some things or under-worry about some things. You don't need anybody fancy to tell you that. But we need to be aware that in that gap, there is risk all by itself. If you worry too much about a cancer that is never going to harm you because you're a really elderly man and you have a slow-growing prostate cancer, you are likely to do a surgery you don't need and harm yourself because of your risk perception gap, not because of the cancer. If you have a risk perception gap because you've heard some questions about vaccines in general, so you don't get a flu shot, and we're not talking about COVID now, we're talking about normal circumstances, you can harm yourself. We over and under worry at our peril. That's what the perception gap is about. So I just wanted to touch on that.
And that clears it up. And in fact, I had experience with that in my medical adventures here. My general practitioner said that, well, do you really want to have a PSA test? Because a gentleman your age, we find that sometimes getting a PSA test, which can be erratic, you know, and not really all that great an indicator of prostate cancer, causes some men to want to have a biopsy and to go to more invasive. A PSA test is just a blood test. No, that's not invasive. But that could cause them to do more invasive procedures, which are not really warranted. So
you are very lucky that your doctor asked. I'm writing a book currently called Rethinking Our Fear of Cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it turns out we've learned that there are cancers that would never go on to kill us. Breast, there are forms of breast cancer, there are forms of prostate, thyroid, lung, colon. And we also have learned that when we find them super, 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 super early, which we've always been preached to, sometimes they are the kinds that would never harm us. But when we hear the C word, we do ourselves all sorts of harm. And there's a chapter on prostate cancer, and most doctors don't even ask their patients, even elderly patients, whether they want a PSA test. They run them as normal. Well, the problem is, the PSA test is notoriously imprecise. You could have a high PSA count riding your bike to the doctor's office. It just means your prostate's irritated, doesn't tell you why. But the doctor comes back and says your level's high, and it's got the C word in the conversation, and you're off to the emotional races. That's precisely what this whole conversation we're having is about, and everybody can empathize with that. There are 60,000 women, Julia, who a year in the United States, roughly, who are diagnosed with what's called ductal carcinoma in situ, a carcinoma, but in the duct of the breast, only in situ, hasn't spread, usually doesn't. And they can predict kind of pretty accurately which ones will and won't. But ductal carcinoma in situ, of those 60,000 women, 58,000 choose to have one or both of their breasts removed. Many of them are harmed for a disease that would never have harmed them, which, by the way, is slow growing enough that you could watch and wait and see and then remove the breast. So we're right on topic with these real world examples. You can feel how emotional they are and how cognitively impenetrable is a phrase psychologists use. How cognitively impenetrable we become when we're afraid to reasoning and rationality and critical thinking, as this show frames it.
I was thinking of a little bit more of a simplistic example for myself, such as the other day I ran into a spider in my house, and it really freaked me out. I really don't like ugly spiders in particular. And I jumped in my car and I raced to the market to get some bug killer.
And risk your life in the car drive. Hello.
Absolutely. Yeah, that spider is completely harmless other than aesthetically offending me.
You know, my book is full of those examples, and it's pretty common sense. You know, there's a literature that has studied it, which I try to make clear in general terms in the book. But duh, you know, who doesn't like jump backwards when there's a snake on the ground and maybe there's a snake behind us, right? Or who among us, you asked at the beginning of the show, you know, when we take risks, there are also benefits. Who doesn't think when they're talking to that attractive person at the bar and you're about to get the phone number and all of that, oh, I'll have one more drink to keep the conversation going, but they're driving home. This is under-worry, but it's the same phenomenon. It's the risk perception gap leading us to harm. There are a zillion societal and personal examples, and that's my work as a writer now, while I'm mostly retired, but as a teacher and a consultant, is to try to make people aware of the emotional nature of risk perception. We can't avoid it. We cannot undo this. It is instinctive. It is totally system one. It is way, we have jumped back from the snake before we thought about jumping back from the snake or are aware of seeing the snake. You can't critical think your way out of this stuff. But it can be harmful. So the more we're aware of it, the more we can reduce that harm.
We're going to try to make a case to you, David, at least I am, that there are ways to critically think your way out of that by trying to shift you from the system one to the system two. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I want to make the comment that one of the things that's different is that we have a lot of data now. We have computers that can access, crunch, store data. and interpret various data sets. And that's one of the big changes. So we have a lot more data and access to the data over the internet and that kind of thing. But I want to get back to this idea that when you're attempting to get away from the emotional component there and to take a sort of systematic, more deliberative look at personal risks that you have in your life, one way or the other. And I want to make the case, too, that there are risks to certain beliefs. Beliefs are things that we can put into actions, and risks are based on actions that we take. The detail I want to get into is this idea that risks and benefits both have a magnitude, which is the severity, which that risk will take, and a probability of happening. So just explain that a little bit to our listeners.
So let's talk about magnitude first. So this is a little quiz that I would do during my presentations and as a speaker. Imagine you had to die tomorrow and you have a choice being eaten alive by a shark or heart disease. Which one would you prefer to go by? Which one sounds worse? Which one are you more afraid of?
Jump in, Julia.
I like the idea of a quick death, so I'm going to go with sharks.
All right, but you answered my question the way I expected, quite frankly. Some people say shark attack because it would be exciting, it would be quick, but what you're describing there is not the magnitude, but the nature of the death. Now let me change it one way, and I'll ask you both again. You will either die burning alive, not so fast either, by the way, or heart disease. Which one do you pick now?
The natural emotional response, mine would be, there's no way I'd want to burn alive.
Okay, so Mr. Data, excuse me, we have a lot of data and all of the rational system two thinking, and that's not how I'm framing the question, obviously. But now let me change it a third way to make this very real and concrete for you and our listeners. You can die tomorrow. You have to die tomorrow. You can either die at the end of cancer or heart disease. And not all heart disease means dying suddenly of heart attack, right? You can have congestive heart failure and slowly suffocate for 2 years. So cancer or heart disease, which one do you pick?
Can I die of vacation?
Yeah, you're on vacation, but it's either cancer or heart disease. While you're on the beach.
Well, again, the first thing that comes to my mind is the emotional response is cancer sounds scarier. So there's no way I would want to die of cancer. Heart disease sounds a little bit more mellow. You could just kind of go, maybe get a little pain in your chest, and that's it.
There are a lot of emotional reasons why we respond to risk the way they do. I've just answered your question about magnitude by saying that it doesn't really matter. What matters is the nature of how you die. The statistical likelihood of dying of heart disease is greater than all three of the alternatives that I gave you. The statistical system two, data-based, rational critical thinking to all of my questions should have been heart disease, oh my God, because it kills more of us. And in fact, in the United States, it kills still about 10% more of us die of heart disease than cancer. But what we respond to, and this is instinctive, and when we talk about system one, don't forget that system one goes off before system two has a chance to even kick into the conversation, at least when it comes to risk. I'll explain that in a minute. What matters to us more than magnitude and those other scientific factors in risk assessment, which if we stop and think and use system two, can enter the conversation. But what matters to us first is the nature of it. In the case of the three that I talked about, the specific magnitude is the magnitude of suffering, not the number. It's the physical experience of. I mean, Julia, ready? You can die tomorrow of X or die tomorrow of being eaten alive by spiders. Boom. Right? That's unlikely, but I bet it's at the top of your list. So let me talk about this speed thing, because it's an important conversation about the challenge of critical thinking about risk, which we'll all be better off with if we do it. So this is the work of Joseph Ledoux, who is a neuroscientist at NYU, and many other people have now done additional work on this. He traced the circuitry in the brain that is the triggering circuitry of the fight or flight response. And here's what he found, and it's been proven and shown in lots of ways. He did it in rats. It's been shown in humans. Okay, so when a stimulus arrives, now you're hearing my voice. When a stimulus arrives, no matter what kind it is, a smell, a sound, a touch, a feeling, a memory, the first place it goes in your brain is called the thalamus. The thalamus acts only as a relay. It does not process it into anything, consciousness, unconsciousness, a knee-jerk reaction, nothing. It's a relay station. And the thalamus sends that raw data in the form of electrical signals between neurons and so forth to a bunch of places in the brain. And the two for this conversation that are critical are the prefrontal cortex behind our forehead, where we do a lot of our system to-ing, and to the amygdala, which I'm sure you've probably heard of. The amygdala is a little almond-shaped organ. There's a right one and a left one. And it is where emotions start. I'm being very simplistic here. Emotions, including fear. Well, what's critical in this biology is the thalamus has to send this message along neural pathways. And the distance between the thalamus and the prefrontal cortex is further than the amygdala. It is right square abutting the amygdala. So what happens, Ledoux has found, is the stimulus comes in. You've seen a spider, Julia. Before anything else happens, the thalamus takes that visual information. It hasn't even gone to the back of your brain for processing in V1, they call it. You know, visual cortex is in the way back. Okay? It sends it to the prefrontal cortex and visual cortex and the amygdala. And before it gets anywhere else, it gets to the amygdala. And the amygdala is your radar, your risk radar. So the amygdala says, I'm driving to the store to get a bunch of bug off, right? Before the message even arrives at your prefrontal cortex, you have begun to physically respond to a risk stimulus. We are hardwired to fear first and think second. Consider that in your conversation about critical thinking, right? But it gets worse. It gets worse. The fact that it's gotten to the amygdala first sets off hormones, you know, stress hormones, all sorts of stuff, which then frames how the prefrontal cortex responds to the signal when it gets it. So basically, the emotion has had the upper hand already. The conversation hasn't even started with your good old thinking brain, right? And the wiring from the thalamus to the amygdala has more power than the wiring from the thalamus to the prefrontal cortex. So the first part of this is we fear first and we think second. The second part of this is biologically, we are hardwired to fear more and think less.
I'd like to shift the question back to how we can nudge ourselves. But I think Julia has a question that kind of goes back to your previous journalistic experience and training with journalists.
Yeah, you know, so what I'm hearing is that communicating and, you know, how risk assessment is done and how people can become better at risk assessment. So my understanding is part of your involvement with risk perception involved training journalists to improve media coverage of risk. I mean, I'm sure many of us have like looked at headlines and thought, oh my God, the world's ending today, or I should be afraid of butter, whatever the scary headline is today. So I'm curious, you know, in training journalists to, you know, improve media coverage of risk, how did that go? And, you know, where do you stand now with regard to that issue? I'm kind of curious your perspective on that.
So when I learned about the psychology of risk perception and which characteristics make a risk scarier or less scary, for example, the nature of the risk and pain and suffering, we're much more afraid of risks when we don't have a sense of control, when we're in the passenger seat of the car instead of with the steering wheel in our hands. We're way more afraid of risks to kids than risks to adults. There's a long list of these, and we can talk more about them. But I would see them in all the stories that I had done, and I would see how I played up all the factors in my stories that made the risk scarier, more dramatic, because as a reporter, I wanted to be the lead story in my newscast, and I wanted to get lots of attention. That's inherent in the culture of journalism. Now, I wasn't the boss. I wasn't selling papers, right? They want to sell the paper, so-called, or the hits on the website and so forth, and get attention. So they're playing up the dramatic for those reasons, all the more so in a world of social media now where he who screams loudest really has to scream even louder to win, right? But the reporter, the people writing the stories who I was doing the training for, they instinctively play up what feels scary to you and me and our listeners, because to them, that makes it a better story. So I felt really guilty about that because I had scared the bejesus out of people disproportionate to the actual fear. I mean, I'd scared them about nuclear power and chemicals and all sorts of things. So I thought that making journalists aware of this emotional language to show them how they're actually harming people, not just making them readers, but leading to choices that are bad for their health, might encourage the responsible journalists in the world to consider that when they make their choices about what verbs to use and which aspects of the story to play up and so forth. And so I taught the psychology of risk perception that we're talking about in newsrooms. And only the newsrooms that really cared about doing it right invited me in the first place. So those are the only ones that I reached, NPR and the National Press Club and some papers. And I'm not sure that it had much effect at all, because instinctively, journalists want attention for their work. That's their culture. That was my culture. And instinctively, they're going to be drawn to those aspects of anything they write about that are more dramatic, and not just with risk. I mean, look at coverage of government. What does it cover, policy or politics? It covers the scream fest and the battle, not what the hell the policy's about. Same thing. So how far it went, Julia? I'm not sure. It made me feel better. The case I was trying to make is this, and it's an important conclusion to this answer. Journalists do have policies about not doing any physical harm. They do. I mean, newsrooms have policies. My TV newsroom didn't report on bomb scares or suicides with the live report, you know, for fear of copycats. The New York Times, the August New York Times, when it, you know, it doesn't rat out where its embedded soldiers are because they could get bombed. They have all sorts of responsible policies about not physically doing harm. Well, my case is that if you scare the bejesus out of people disproportionately, guess what? The choices they make are doing them harm. Did it work? I don't know. It made me feel better. I hope it made a couple people think about a couple things along the way.
And that's the same feeling that we have with this show. And I want to get Great. Back to how we get away from our instinctive nature and nudge ourselves. But I do want to remind folks that we are talking to David Ropeik, a mostly retired consultant, author, teacher, and speaker on the topic of risk perception. And we will also get into what we like to call risk-benefit analysis. So how can we nudge ourselves? Because we've talked about how hard it is, the amygdala in play and all of that. And Julia demonstrated how her fear of spiders comes first to her mind, how my burning to death enrages me or scares me and comes to mind. But we're in agreement, I think, that the data is out there. We can access data. It's possible to make a deliberative, more rational balance between risks and benefits. How do we nudge ourselves? Are there any techniques that you can talk about that might allow us to move into that system two thinking?
It's important that we talked about the biology earlier, because the best technique for making better risk decisions is to give yourself a little more time to make them. Because instinctively, you will go with system one. I mean, system one is designed to do that. You've talked a lot about system one and how it's instinctive and quick. Well, it's quick because the brain evolved when we didn't know where our next meal was. And the brain uses lots of calories to do anything. And so we have all these shortcuts for making quick decisions, especially when there's a snake on the ground in front of us. That better be a quick decision. If you make the wrong one or you don't react quickly and it's a poisonous snake, you're out of the gene pool. And that technique for risk perception doesn't survive. It's not adaptive, right? Okay. So the first technique I would suggest to anybody, and I try to do myself with mixed success, is to stop for 2 breaths or 2 minutes whenever you're facing any kind of a choice where there's something that could go wrong that could hurt me. Let's not call it the word risk, right? Let's put it in real terms, right? I'm dealing with a cancer choice. I'm dealing with, do I jaywalk? I'm dealing with any kind of a it could hurt me situation. Stop. Don't let system one scream you out of using system two. Your listeners know this. Then be aware of the emotional characteristics of the choice that may be interfering with your critical thinking. So let me give you a concrete example. That all sounds abstract. So I'll give you a couple statistics first about using a mobile phone when you drive. It's a common experience. Many of us do it, either handheld or now hands-free. It impairs your brain. It does not impair your hand. Your driving gets worse because you're distracted mentally. Okay, so there's a fact. And there's lots of data behind that. But that's the fact that you need to know as you're making this choice. The problem is what my brain's going to be doing. So now you're driving along in your car and you've been waiting for that critical message from your wife or husband or partner or that publisher who's going to say yes or no to your book, and the phone rings in your car, right? And you are on a hands-free system. That sounds like it's good, right? Because you can keep your hands on the phone. But Dave just told you that the hand has nothing to do with cell phones making you a crummier driver, right? So you know that too. The phone rings. Stop and ask yourself, how's traffic? Is there a place I can pull over? Do I really need to take the call? You're taking a breath. And then remind yourself of this. And here's Dave's lesson. We feel less afraid when we're in control. Doesn't matter what that control is. The car is a perfect metaphor for it. We're driving. The steering wheel's in our hand, the pedals at our foot, and boy, we've taken control because we're using a hands-free device. Aren't we good? But I've just told you the facts, Bob, right? The data, if you will, that your brain is the problem, not your hand, right? So you also know that, but you also know that you're being deceived into a complacency because there are all these circumstances that make you feel like you have control. Now I've added to your data. That's a data point. That's knowledge. So now you've got all this in your head. Dave told me that control can just seduce me into taking risks that I shouldn't. Dave told me that my brain is the problem, but the stopping and waiting for 30 seconds, two rings of the phone, is the technique to allow all that information in that can lead you to a more fact-based choice.
Asking good questions is always a way to kind of engage our curiosity. So those are big ones for me, is asking questions, being curious about the risk rather than going with our initial feelings and fears is, I think, an important aspect of this. And if we're in a situation, what I've thought of too, when we start to write things down, it always formalizes things. So thinking about the risks and benefits and making a list, and that would cause us to actually then do some more research on the subject.
Well, it might. And so there are a couple stumbling blocks in that technique. First of all, writing things down forces you to slow down.
Yeah.
The very act of writing things down means you're not just going with the quick first judgment. That's, yes. We're talking the same language, right? So, but the problem with getting more information is where you get it from. Well, there are two problems with getting more information. So you're familiar with Herbert Simon and his concept of bounded rationality?
Yeah.
Okay, so the simplistic idea for listeners who haven't heard it is our ability to be rational is bounded by the fact that we don't usually have time to get all the facts and ask all the questions. Thank you, Bob. We don't have time to write everything down. We don't have the intellectual ability to make sense of complicated astrophysics when we're talking about, is the meteor going to hit my head? And we don't have the availability of all that information, even if we do have the time, right? We just don't know some things. Our ability to be rational is bounded, but we have to make a quick decision to survive. Is that line on the ground a snake or a stick? Not a time to make a list. Not a time to ask questions. Well, that's a simplistic metaphor, but that's how our body reacts to any kind of a scary circumstance, is because it has to. As I said, you know, that's adapted. So with bounded rationality, we generally tend to jump fast. And then, because emotion speaks louder than reason in that whole biology I talked about, the sources that we turn to online asking questions are going to be framed by the emotional state that we're in. So, for example, people facing a cancer diagnosis are going to go online and they're going to go to all of the people who had cancer kind of websites. Well, by default, those are people who have awful stories to tell. That's why they're online. But that's not just rationally seeking information, it's seeking information that feels like it answers how you're feeling. There's another big problem with the beliefs thing that you mentioned earlier, Bob, which is a really important point I want to get in there. We are social animals. We depend on each other for lots of things, not least of which, as we were evolving, for literally our survival. If the lion attacked, we needed everybody to help fight the lion, right? So we needed to know that everybody that we were around was on the same team. Because if there's some schmo in the tribe who disagrees with the tribe's beliefs, he's a weak spot in our defense against the lion. So tribal unity, tribal loyalty is significantly, biologically, profoundly, deeply programmed into us as a social being. Think about all the ways that all of us are judging others all the time. Do I trust them? Do I not? Their body language, their face, their voice, you know. Our ability to sense, our need to sense that we are trusted by our tribe so that we feel safe, literally trumps fear of anything else. Let me give you a concrete example. There are people in this country who so cling to their tribal beliefs about masks and vaccines that though they have relatives they're escorting to the hospital and never see alive again from COVID, still won't change their mind about masks and vaccines because that tribal loyalty, the need for that, for a sense of safety, trumps fear of this disease that's killing people all around them. Consider that dynamic. Consider how profound the power of needing to demonstrate, reinforce our tribal loyalty is as a survival mechanism. And what that gets back to, Bob, in the question you asked, sorry, this is a long, convoluted bringing it back to your question, is, are those people going to be objective information seekers? Probably not. And that's just an extreme example for all of us. Is Julie going to be an objective information seeker when she sees the spider? She's going to get in the car. Boy, it's a real tough one when you say about getting more information. Yes, we can. Yes, we should. I encourage it. Stopping, pausing, making lists, all good techniques. Super important to recognize that our emotions can be harmful all by itself. That's why I coined this phrase, the perception gap, to sound that warning. Like you're showing, sounding with the show, super hard to do. I know all this stuff. I still find it for myself very hard to do.
And I agree, it is hard to do. It is the sum and substance of a thread that runs through this show is to understand these vulnerabilities that we have in terms of our bias. But on the flip side, there are people working hard on de-biasing techniques because they are aware of how strong the biasing forces are, trying to come up with means and methods that we can all take advantage of to de-bias ourselves, to become aware of our biases, and to move beyond the boundaries of our biases. So, no, in those quick response situations, if we see a snake, hear a rustle in the bush, walking in Northern California where we have mountain lions, we don't have time to make lists and think about all these other ways of nudging ourselves towards this more deliberate system too, thinking. But there are many, many other cases. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be doing this show in the first place, that we can find to move ourselves to take a step back, to not look at information that confirms our fears, our biases, but to look at the opposing information too, maybe even first, you know.
So let me give you an example. You were asking earlier about techniques, and I love this conversation because it's precisely about what my work is too, which is be aware of the foibles so that you cannot be a victim of them. Mm-hmm. The case that I make is these foibles can kill you. That's a pretty convincing reason. It has nothing to do with what you're in to pay attention to them, right? So that's how I try to teach it.
Yeah.
Risk perception is about survival, right? But let me give you an example of this. So I don't know your politics, but let's just say for a moment that they're progressive or left or moderate or whatever you want, okay? So let's say that when you invited me and I said yes to your invitation, I said that I believe in the QAnon theory and I'm arch right wing. Would we be having this conversation? Let's make it easier. You're in a bar. You know, one of the de-biasing techniques is to have people who disagree be in conversation, but not about, you know, things that trigger their identities, right? Their tribal identities, right? Let's talk about Santa Claus or, you know, something generic, right? You're in a bar and you're having a wonderful conversation with this person. And this person says, yeah, but they stole the election. That's like seeing the snake.
I'd order another drink is my reaction.
Or, turning to have a conversation with the other guy. That's like a snake. You know, it's not just these physical simplistic things that I'm doing. The same thing is tribal disloyalty, danger, danger, danger. Heart rate goes up. Stress hormones come out that interferes with your thinking, literally, biologically. I didn't want to leave the conversation without pointing out that it's not just these simplistic analogies. It's absolutely second what you're saying. Lots of techniques that can move us in the direction of healthier risk decision-making. Yes. That's why we're having this conversation.
And apropos that you bring up examples like that, because on our very last show that was with Julia and I, we had no guests. I acknowledged that I have lost my patience in some realms in dealing with some of these issues that have to do with the pandemic in terms of people denying the science and that sort of thing. And I did a little mea culpa with that, saying, look, I know all these techniques, and we've had three different series on having good conversations with people and civil dialogue and that sort of thing. But yet I find that I lose patience to the point of not even wanting to talk to that person anymore about it. I understand this completely.
It's not just an intellectual thing.
No.
It's really a survival thing.
Sure.
That attitude and that tribe's literally, physically, because they're not vaccinated, threatening you.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's real animal stuff.
Yeah. And we were talking about the importance of taking an evolutionary perspective when looking at what we biologically developed to survive in versus what we have now in our culture, which is much more complex. But there are a lot of good people working on trying to find ways to overcome that. In fact, we're going to do our next show with a representative from Braver Angels, which is one of the organizations that really does a lot of work with this.
Actually, I got a couple of questions. I wanted to touch on something else real quick that has come up in a few of our recent shows. The way you framed the advice of having that system one, that quick reaction, and then taking a pause, whether it's a couple of breaths, whether it's half a minute, whether it's 5 minutes, to allow yourself to process that, not just react, I think is really good advice. A little side question I have is, aren't we also sort of retraining or enhancing our system one response every time we do that?
So if you go down a path and see a snake, it's a really handy thing to remember you saw that snake there so that next time you can be aware. And here's the problem with that, and we'll get back to Kahneman and Tversky and all the biases and heuristics. Your brain stores that information more urgently. It stores it in a way that makes it come screaming out of memory to make it useful to you faster and louder than some data point. The statistical likelihood of seeing a snake again on that same trail is, 0.00 something. Yeah, well, that may be in your brain, but your memory, what you're asking about, Julia, your experience of an emotion, any emotion, but we're talking about risk and fear, burns more deeply into the hippocampus and other parts of the brain where memory is stored in, and is more readily called back up into consciousness through the amygdala, by the way, faster and louder. And it's called availability bias. You might have heard of it or read about it, right? So what that means is it's more available, more readily available, and more emotionally available to your consciousness. And as a result, your brain gives it more say. The system one stuff burns in louder. The system one stuff is more available. But to take up Bob's side of the argument, if I may, right? We do have lots of memories of lots of things. It was only a garter snake. I felt like a dope. That's part of it. I mean, I have this. There's a trail that I walk with curvy roots on the ground. I practice this literally, right? I can know that it's not only stupid of me, but potentially dangerous to get things wrong. I have experiences with that in my life. Yes, those are teaching moments too. Be aware of them too. Unfortunately, biologically, they simply don't burn into our memory system, the neurons and all of that sort of stuff, with the impact that system one stuff does. But absolutely, we should learn from them. And yes, I would say most of us have had experiences where we realize we made a silly choice and try to learn from that going forward.
I think it's interesting because you guys mentioned snakes. I'm actually quite a fan of snakes and have handled many. And it's with exposure and experience, something people become more comfortable with.
Here's a technique. So you know what cognitive behavioral therapy is? For the listeners who don't, you expose yourself very gradually to a stimulus that's scary so that step at a time, you know, to a snake, let's say, that's not dangerous, right? So a step at a time so that ultimately you expose yourself to that actual stimulus and your brain experiences the stimulus without harm. Absolutely. In fact, there's even a drug called propranolol that if it's administered within a certain time window after that experience, erases your fear, literally. Go online, propranolol. There are lots of experiments where you see people who are freaked out, scary. There's one about spiders. There's one about cats. And they're gradually introduced. You know, you have a conversation with the person. We're going to go into a room where there's a snake. Nope, come back tomorrow. Very gradual, right? And the next day you walk down the hall to the door. Oh, come back tomorrow. So it's a step at a time, right? Ultimately, the person comes into the room and sees the cat or the snake or whatever and goes, cringy, cringy, cringy. But the snake doesn't bite him and the cat is friendly. They leave the room, they take the propranolol, and the next day they come into the room and they don't have the emotional experience at all, which speaks to the biology of all of this. But yes, it's a technique. Sorry, long answer. Sorry.
No, that's very interesting. It's, I think, something I'm sure we all grapple with in some way or another in our lives, you know, and steering this more towards, you know, risk and risk benefit. Some people, I find it's very common, you know, people will really fixate about risk. You know, they're terrified, you know, of butter is going to give them heart disease and taking too much Advil is going to, you know, whatever. There's a lot to be afraid of in this world, but without considering the benefits, you know, that snake is the reason you don't have mice in your house, you know, that spider is the reason I don't have mosquitoes in my house. And then also, I will also say there's a very small population too, who excessively focus on benefits without risk, the positive thinkers of this world. Anyways, let's talk a little bit about the process of weighing benefits and risk. You know, we all have probably done the pros and cons list at some point in time. When we're talking about these really like heavy issues, these life-changing, life-ending issues, whether it's medical decisions, government policy, technology, family, how do we approach weighing risks and benefits?
So there are two levels of that. The personal and the societal. All right, so let's start at the societal. And I'll give you a good example. For Northern California, I bet you there's lots of people who feel strongly about genetically modified food.
So, it just so happens our county has made it illegal to grow GMO crops.
Okay. Super bad for society because the harms are minimal according to the vast body of science and the benefits are being foregone. There's GMOs, mosquitoes that can breed out the ones that could cause malaria. And, you know, I could go down the list. And I'm only talking about what the science is, not as an advocate. You know, I just read up on this stuff as Bob advises. And it looks to me like the benefits to society are massively, massively, massively greater than the kind of supposed harms. That's not a weighing of the facts. The folks in general, and I have friends among them who are just I would die first opponents of GM foods, generally belong to a tribe of shared values about environmental issues in general. And their position on GMOs is a test of their tribal loyalty to those overall values, all honorable values. I share many of them. But you can't be for GMOs or for nuclear power, let's say, and then proclaim that you want to, you know, go back to the Garden of Eden kind of environmentalism. See, it's a tribal violation. So are they weighing these things? Nope. You know, do the risk assessors in science do it like Bob would like? And I would like, thank you. Absolutely. But when society votes in your county or whatever, that's not what they're doing. So that's the societal level. Now let's get to the personal level. I'll be a little bit blunt about this, but you're in the passionate throes of pre-lovemaking relationships. And you know that having protection during sex is probably a good idea for lots of reasons. Yeah, are you weighing the risks and benefits of that? Nope. I'm using a gross, simplistic example, right? I'm late for the meeting and I'm speeding. I know that's dangerous, but the meeting's important to me. Are you weighing the risks and the benefits? Nope. There are techniques to answer Bob's question that allow you to do this, though. And now we'll talk about the heuristics and biases literature again. So you've probably already had discussions about what's called optimism bias. For listeners who haven't heard that, that's, yeah, but it won't happen to me. And people are invariably, optimistically, overly, it won't happen to me, about lots of things, especially when they compare themselves to others. I will be less likely to be hospitalized than them, you put it that way. When the risk is abstract and far away, so you can try to be, think about the benefits without the scary, by removing optimism bias. And the way to do that is think of the risk is happening to you tomorrow. Make it imminent, because a risk down the road, or just abstract, or an idea, easy to be optimistic about. When you're standing on the deck of the ship and you've been planning on going scuba diving in those waters, and you know there are sharks in those waters, and you know all the facts about sharks don't eat people, and you've been planning it for 6 months, and it sounds so cool, and now you're on the deck of the ship, and there's a fin in the water, now you're not optimistic. Now what kicks in is what's called loss aversion. You overly weight the emotional downside of the choice. You know that shark is a kind that won't eat, it's a nurse shark or something, right? Or it's a spider that is not a particularly poisonous spider, let's say, okay? Right? You know all that, but when it's imminent, we divert to overweighting the fear. And when it's abstracting down the road, we overweight the optimism, it won't happen to me. And in the risk-benefit calculus you're asking about, Julia, those are good tools to have in mind so you can weight the choice one way or the other and get to a more rational choice about it. Am I being too optimistic? Am I overweighting the loss? Is it too imminent? Is it too far down the road? This is a simple, simple, simple conversation you can have with yourself to decide whether you want to drive to the store and buy the bug bomb.
It really highlights the importance of knowing the psychology behind how we make decisions, being aware of it and trying to find some workarounds to come to more reasonable and accurate decisions and beliefs. We're getting close to the end of the show here, but I do have to weight us towards this idea of how do we get away from our natural inclinations. So I have a question for you. You brought up the idea of a drug. Maybe we could find a drug that shifts us to critical thinking, but I doubt that that's very practical at this point.
Well, I don't know the self-propanolol. It just erases those fears within cognitive behavior.
What I've been thinking about a lot is creating some sort of a module for people to actually do a more systematic approach to risk-benefit. So assuming we wanted to design a critical thinking tool to assist people in better assessing the balance between risks and benefits, using a structured approach that teaches the concepts as it goes and leads the user to eventually put the data into an automatic calculator. The calculator can crunch the numbers and weigh the probability and severity of the risk benefits and that sort of thing. We don't have to do that. We put it into a calculator and we make this into a module. Now, we've had a previous guest, Thinking Clearly, episode number 44, Spencer Greenberg, and he does a website called Clearer Thinking, where they make these kinds of modules, and they're teaching modules. Very good idea. But how would you do that? If I was going to ask you to help with your experience on risk perception and what we've been talking about, how would you design such a module?
Thank you. So first, I want to commend the work in this specific regard of David Spiegelhalter in the UK and Gerd Gigerenzer, two risk analysts who have done a huge amount of work to help with one particular challenge in risk perception, which is innumeracy. Mm-hmm. Not we're too dumb, but a lot of educated people have struggles with numbers too. You know, risks are often given as percentages, 1 in 100 and 1% stuff. So they've done an awful lot of work with helping us be more rational in the use of numbers. And David uses a metric that he's devised called the micromort, which is basically, he's calculated roughly, for every half hour of your life, are you likely to take off how many half hours of your life are you likely to take off by smoking a cigarette? How many half hours of your life, micromorts, are you likely to take off your life by a bunch of behaviors? So that number is out there. So metrics. But I would say, I would offer a different approach, an additional approach. And you said it exactly right, Bob. We have to be aware that our risk perception system has flaws in it because of how we evolve that are dangerous. That's the first step towards avoiding those mistakes. Being aware that the psychology of risk perception, which, by the way, has helped us survive so far, right? So you can't completely knock it. We've made it this far down evolution's gauntlet, but it has flaws, especially for more complicated things, not the quick snake sort of stuff. So being aware that the psychology of risk perception can lead to a risk perception gap is the very first step towards driving slower on the highway and all these sorts of things. Then, and forgive me, I don't want to sound like I'm hyping my book, know what the emotional factors are that make things scarier or not. Understand the details of that psychology. Every bit as much as you understand the details of the risk itself, because that psychology, as much as those details of risk itself, are what's shaping your choice. And when they're apparent to you, when you know that more or less control or more, you know, it's a risk to kids or pain and suffering, all those sorts of factors are in play and you recognize them, come to recognize them, that's the technique that I would suggest. And it helps me a little.
Well, David, I'm sure this is going to come up on future shows, and I'm still working on ideas related to coming up with this module.
Future shows, as my mother would say, if we're lucky enough to live that long.
Yeah. But we're going to have to wrap it up for this episode. Yeah. Enjoyed it very much. Thank you for taking the risk to come on our show and talking about the importance of careful and accurate considerations of both the risks and the benefits as a critical thinking tool. Now, on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your books, How Risky Is It Really?, and your earlier book, Risk, A Practical Guide for Deciding What's Really Safe and What's Really Dangerous in the World Around You, and we'll be anxiously awaiting the book that you're working on right now. Post links to those books and to your webpage, which is DROPEIK.com. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post, David?
No, and just a warning, the DROPEIK.com is pretty badly out of date because being a retiree mostly, although I'm doing projects, I haven't bothered to update it, but dive in. It's a way to contact me and stuff like that, just to cash it. But okay. Thank you for this opportunity. Lively conversation.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. And a big shout out to our listeners. Thank you for listening. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thank you, Bob. And thanks for joining us, David.
And until
I was going to mention that spider on your ceiling that I see on the Zoom conversation.
You're freaking her out. And Julia, until next time, keep thinking
clearly.